This is the second day of this November 2016 seven-day session. We'll return to our text from yesterday, a book called The Zen Teaching of Hui Hai on Sudden Illumination, translated by John Blofeld. This is still in question and answer form. The answer, of course, would be Hui Hai. Question: when the mind rests in a state of purity, will that not give rise to some attachment to purity? Answer: if on reaching the state of purity you refrain from thinking, "Now my mind is resting in purity," there will be no such attachment. Purity, by the way, we can understand, well, one way to understand it is a state of emptiness or non-attachment, where there's no clinging to thought. It's a state of no thought. This scenario, "Now my mind is resting in purity," will be familiar to some people in one form or another, because this is what typically happens when we get into one state or another that we feel is promising, positive. Then right away the mind will say, "Okay, you're doing well now, good, keep it up, you can't have far to go now," and so forth. Whatever the version of it is, there's a self-consciousness. That's what he's talking about. As long as that is not there, there will be no such attachment. It's a very advanced state to not have the mind reflecting on one's state and appraising one's state. Question: when the mind rests in a state of void, will that not entail some attachment to void, emptiness? Answer: if you think of your mind as resting in a state of void, then there will be such an attachment. So the key word is think. Question: when the mind reaches the state of not dwelling upon anything and continues in that state, won't there be some attachment to its not dwelling upon anything? This guy. Answer: so long as your mind is fixed solely on emptiness, on the void, there is nothing to which you can attach yourself. If you want to understand the non-dwelling mind very clearly, while you are actually sitting in meditation, you must be aware only of the mind and not permit yourself to make judgments. That is, you must avoid evaluations in terms of good, evil, or anything else. Whatever is past, so do not sit in judgment upon it. For when thinking about the past ceases of itself, it can be said that there is no longer any past. Whatever is in the future is not here yet, so don't direct your hopes and longings toward it. For when thinking about the future ceases of itself, it can be said that there is no future. This is not just intellectual stuff. Where is the past if we have no thoughts of the past? Where is it? I don't see it. Where is it? Looking around. Where is the past when there's no memory or thought of the past? And the same with the future. Where is it? And then he turns to the present. Whatever is present is now at hand. Just be conscious of your non-attachment to everything. Non-attachment is the sense of not allowing any love or aversion for anything to enter your mind. For when thinking about the present ceases of itself, we may say that there is no present. When there is no clinging to any of these three periods, past, present, or future, they may be said not to exist. And this, of course, is a state of great freedom. freedom from time, from the limitations, the constraints, the pressures of time. He continues, a mind which dwells upon nothing is the Buddha mind, the mind of one already liberated, Bodhi mind, uncreated mind. It is also called realization that the nature of all appearances is unreal. If you have not realized it yet, you must strive and strive, you must increase your exertions. Then, when your efforts are crowned with success, you will have attained to understanding from within yourself, an understanding stemming from a mind that abides nowhere, by which we mean a mind free from delusion and reality alike. A mind disturbed by love and aversion, meaning, or desire, usually it's desire and aversion, or love and hate, a mind free from both of them is real, and a mind thus freed reaches the state in which opposites are seen as void, whereby freedom and liberation are obtained. A couple of points here. This, a mind which dwells upon nothing. I think he's in this paragraph, there is more to it that's a little harder to read, but in this paragraph he's really talking about the predominant practice of his time. This is the 8th century, which was Shikantaza. This was before koans existed as things that one worked on. Shikantaza, another word for that is silent illumination, which we see in the title of the book. But the same would be true of the breath or a koan. We can, in absorbing ourselves in the breath or the koan, it leads to a state of dwelling upon nothing. We have to acknowledge that when we're concentrated on the word mu, for example, okay, it's kind of something, it's a word, but it's for the purpose of leading us to this realm where there is no abiding, no dwelling. Same with the breath. It's still, it has a word, breath. In that sense, we can say it's something. We're dwelling upon something. We're dwelling upon the breath. But there too, it's if we completely give ourselves to it, then it leads us beyond the breath itself. Just as being completely absorbed in mu takes us beyond what we call mu. Something indescribable, unnameable. Here, this sentence, if you have not realized it yet, you must strive and strive. You must increase your exertions. Some of you will remember from other Chinese Zen texts, having one great master or another saying, whatever you do, don't strive. And here he says, you must strive and strive, you must increase your exertions. So they seem to be contradictory, but I don't believe they can be, that what all of these teachers realized was that if you're striving is based on grasping for something, trying to get somewhere or get something, then that's not going to work. So when he says, when this teacher, Wei Hai, says you must strive and strive, you must increase your exertions, he really means to get closer and closer to the practice we're working on. Close that gap. Become the breath. Become the koan. Press on without grasping. It's not the same. We can exert ourselves without grasping at something. And then this phrase, a mind free from delusion and reality alike. Someone might ask, okay, good, free from delusion, but why would I want to be free from reality? Well, he really means the thought of reality, the concept of reality. Question, are we to make this effort only when we are sitting in meditation or also when we are walking about? I think anyone here could answer that question, but let's hear what Wei Hai says. Answer, when I spoke just now of making an effort, I did not mean only when you are sitting in meditation. For whether you are walking, standing, sitting, lying, or whatever you are doing, you must uninterruptedly exert yourselves all the time. This is what we call constantly abiding in that state. State of awareness, of non-attachment to thoughts. This too is very, very advanced state to do it uninterruptedly. But we can approach that state in a session where we're doing so much sitting day after day. We need to try to approach that state. Be aware. Be mindful when we leave the zendo that we don't leave our practice back in the zendo. Question, what is meant by proficiency in teaching but not in transmission? There's a footnote here. In this context, it says teaching means preaching the Dharma according to the sutras. Transmission means teaching or conveying an intuitive understanding of truths realized through direct experience. And there is therefore independent of the sutras. So in this context, teaching is based on doctrine, and transmission comes out of experience. So again, what is meant by proficiency in teaching of the sutras, but not in transmission? Answer, it refers to those whose words are at variance with their deeds. questioning. What is meant by proficiency in transmission and also in teaching? Answer: it refers to people whose words are confirmed by their deeds. So maybe to state the obvious, one can develop all kinds of knowledge about the Dharma, Buddhism, Buddhist doctrine, without knowing it through direct experience. And that is what what this exchange is pointing out, that there's a huge difference. We can learn a lot from those who just have a scholastic understanding of the Dharma. It can be very useful, but the two must never be confused. Learning more and more and more and more about Buddhist doctrine or Zen principles does not bring liberation, real rest, peace of mind, freedom. Here's a dialogue about hell. Question: is there really a hell? Answer: there is and there is not. How so? In that our minds have constructed many sorts of evil karma, there is hell. But since everyone's self-nature is void, for those whose minds have been freed of attachment's stains, there can be no hell. Question: do evildoers possess the Buddha nature? Answer: yes, they have it too. Question: then if they too have this nature, does it enter hell with them or not? Answer: it does not enter with them. Question: but when they enter hell, where is their Buddha nature? Answer: it also enters hell. Question: that being so, while they are undergoing retribution there, does their Buddha nature share the retribution? Answer: no. Although Buddha nature remains with these people while they're in hell, it is the individuals themselves who suffer. Buddha nature is fundamentally beyond retribution. And then the questioner takes one more stab. Yet, if they enter together, how can the Buddha nature not suffer? Answer: sentient beings possess forms, and whatsoever has form is subject to formation and destruction. Whereas the Buddha nature is formless, and being formless is immaterial, for which reason it is the very nature of the void itself and cannot be destroyed. Were someone to make a pile of kindling in a vacuum, the kindling would come to harm, but not the vacuum. In this analogy, the vacuum symbolizes Buddha nature, and the kindling represents sentient beings. Therefore, it is written, they enter together, but do not suffer together. Here is he turns to the topic of fame, which is one of those eight winds we talked about yesterday that have great ability to unsettle the mind. Do not seek for empty fame, mouthing forth talk of the Absolute with minds like those of apes. When talk contradicts actions, that is known as self-deception. It will lead to your falling headlong into evil states of rebirth. Don't seek fame and happiness in this lifetime at the cost of unenlightenment and suffering for long eons to come. Strive on, strive on. Sentient beings must save themselves. The Buddhas cannot do it for them. Always remember, Buddhas, when it's plural, means the enlightened ones. Sentient beings means the so-called unenlightened ones. The Buddhas cannot do it for them. If they could, since there have already been Buddhas as numerous as grains of dust, every single being must by now have been saved. Then how is it that you and I are still being tossed upon the waves of life and death instead of having become Buddhas? Do please realize that sentient beings have to save themselves and that the Buddhas cannot do it for them. Strive on, strive on. Do it for yourselves. Place no reliance upon the powers of the Buddhas. It's really very, very interesting here that he includes himself in those who haven't yet become Buddhas. How is it that you and I are still being tossed upon the waves of life and death instead of having become Buddhas? Suppose it could be said that the further we go in practice, the more glaring becomes our unfinished work. To Wei Hai, he's aware of the fact that he hasn't come to perfect enlightenment yet. As Zen Master Dogen said, something like, if you have arrived, keep going. You only get it when you're halfway. If you think you're finished, you're not there yet. Question: in the coming generation, there will be many followers of mixed beliefs. How are we to live side by side with them? It's a very topical question in a country as diverse as ours, with people of so many different religions. Answer: share the light with them, but do not share their karmas. Although you may be staying with them, your minds will not dwell in the same place as theirs. There is a sutra which says, though it follows the current of circumstances, its nature is unchanging. As to those other followers of the way, so these now he's talking about Buddhists, you are all practicing the way for the sake of that great cause, liberation. So, while never despising those who have not practiced the Dharma, you should respect those who are practicing it as you would respect the Buddha. So it's a call for non-sectarianism within the Dharma. Do not vaunt your own virtues, nor envy the abilities of others. Examine your own actions. Do not hold up the faults of others. Thus, nowhere will you encounter obstruction, and you will naturally enjoy happiness. This classic broad-mindedness of Buddhism, tolerance. Think of the mortal combat, the centuries of mortal combat between the Sunnis and the Shia. This quote from a sutra, though it follows the current of circumstances, its nature is unchanging. I would take that to be that we can adapt and accommodate others without thinking that we've sacrificed anything. We can maintain our integrity while accommodating others, others' beliefs. That brings us to the end of the first part of this book, which is the same title as the book's title, Zen Teaching of Weihai on Sudden Illumination. Part two is the Tsung-Ching Record of the Zen Master Weihai, also known as the Great Pearl, a collection of dialogues recorded by the monk Tsung-Ching of Huayan Monastery in the city of Yu. Once the master began his daily address to his disciples by saying, "I am no Chan adept. Indeed, I have not a single thing to offer anyone, so I must not keep you standing here longer. Go and take a rest." There's a footnote there. Take a rest. It's a Chinese idiom. Means you should set your minds at rest. And then the footnote says, the Chinese wording contains the idea of go to yourself. So the saying is a direct pointing at the mind. Go to yourself. I have not a single thing to offer anyone, so I must not keep you standing here any longer. And then it continues, in those days the number of people who came to practice under him was gradually increasing. As day follows night, they came and pressed him for instruction. He was compelled to answer their questions as soon as asked, thus revealing his unimpeded powers of dialectic. Endless discussions took place with questions and answers following one upon another. Once a group of Dharma masters, and this clearly does not mean Chan masters, he has in parentheses learned preachers, so it's probably more Buddhist scholars. Once a group of Dharma masters sought an interview and said, "We have some questions to ask. Are you prepared to answer them, Master?" And then Weihai, "Yes." The moon is reflected in that deep pond. Catch it if you like. Another footnote. The moon stands for enlightenment and the pond water for self-nature. The implication is, how can enlightenment be caught? And then the first question, what is the Buddha really like? Way high. If that which is facing the limpid pond is not the Buddha, what is it? So he's addressing them as they're facing the pond. The monks were puzzled by this reply. After a long pause, they inquired again, Master, what dharma or doctrine do you expound in order to liberate others? Wei Hai, this poor monk has no dharma by which to liberate others. All Chan masters are the same stuff, they exclaimed, whereat the master asked them, What dharmas do you virtuous ones expound for liberating others? Answer, Oh, we expound the Diamond Sutra. Wei Hai, how many times have you expounded it? More than 20 times. By whom was it spoken? To this the monks answered indignantly, Master, you must be joking. Of course you know that it was spoken by the Buddha. And then Wei Hai, well, that sutra states, if someone says the Tathagata expounds the Dharma, he thereby slanders the Dharma. Such a man will never understand what I mean. That's the end of the sutra passage that Wei Hai is quoting. Then Wei Hai says, now, if you say that it was not expounded by the Buddha, you will thereby belittle that sutra. Will you virtuous ones please let me see what you have to say to that? As they made no reply, the master paused a while before asking his next question, which was, The Diamond Sutra says, He who seeks me through outward appearance or seeks me in sound treads the heterodox path and cannot perceive the Tathagata. And then he says to them, Tell me, virtuous ones, who or what is the Tathagata? Answer, Sir, at this point I find myself utterly deluded. And Wei Hai, having never been, he's not even going to let that pass, having never been illumined, how can you say that you are now deluded? So then the monk who had spoken asked, Will the Venerable Chan Master expound the Dharma to us? And then Wei Hai, though you have expounded the Diamond Sutra over 20 times, you still do not know the Tathagata? These words caused the monks to prostrate themselves again and to beg the master to explain further. So he said, The Diamond Sutra states, The Tathagata is the suchness of all dharmas, all phenomena. How can you have forgotten that? And then one of them said, Yes, yes, the suchness of all dharmas. And then Wei Hai said, Virtuous ones, yes, is also incorrect. And then one of them says, On that point, the sutra is very clear. How can we be wrong? And then Wei Hai, Then, virtuous ones, are you that suchness too? Answer, Yes, we are. Wei Hai, And are plants and rocks the suchness? They are. Then is the suchness of you virtuous ones the same as the suchness of plants and rocks? Answer, there is no difference. Wei Hai, then how do you virtuous ones differ from plants and rocks? This silenced the monks for some time, until at last one of them exclaimed with a sigh, It is hard to keep our end up in discussions with a man so very much our superior. After a considerable pause, what do they go off to the bathroom or the drink of water? they inquired, "How can Mahaparinirvana be attained?" Wei Hai, "By avoiding all samsaric deeds, those which keep you in the round of birth and death." Question, "What deeds are they?" Wei Hai, "Well, seeking nirvana is a samsaric deed. Casting off impurity and clinging to purity is another. Harboring attainments and proofs of attainment is another. And so is failure to discard rules and precepts." He's hitting them in all their soft spots. They probably had it lodged in their minds that seeking nirvana is a good deed, and he says it's a samsaric deed, still in the realm of grasping. They probably had it in their minds that purity is good and impurity is bad. He says casting off impurity and clinging to purity is another. And they probably had some pride about what they had attained, such as it was. And he says harboring attainments and proofs of attainment is another. And so is failure to discard rules and precepts. That would have also been pretty mind-blowing to them. So they ask, "Please tell us how to achieve liberation." Wei Hai, "Never having been bound, you have no need to seek liberation. Straightforward functioning and straightforward conduct cannot be surpassed." "Ah," exclaimed the monks, "people like this venerable Chan master are indeed rare." Then they bowed their thanks and left. This sentence, "straightforward functioning and straightforward conduct cannot be surpassed." You could understand this word "straightforward" as straightforward functioning as functioning with an undivided mind. Being one with what you're doing. Same with straightforward conduct. Clean. Uncomplicated. Simple. This is really what purity means. Another exchange. Once a man who practiced Chan asked the master, "It is said that mind is identical with the Buddha, but which of these is really the Buddha?" Wei Hai, "What do you suppose is not Buddha? Point it out to me." As there was no answer, the master added, "If you comprehend the mind, Buddha is omnipresent to you. But if you do not awaken to it, you will remain astray and distant from Buddha forever." And then he's approached by a master of the Vinaya school. The Vinaya is the school that stressed, put it as its central concern, the monastic rules and regulations. So a master of the Vinaya sect named Fa Ming once remarked, "You Chan masters do a lot of tumbling about in the emptiness of the void." To which Wei Hai said, "On the contrary, venerable sir, it is you who tumble a lot in the emptiness of the void." "How can that be?" exclaimed Fa Ming in astonishment. Wei Hai, "The sutras are just words, mere ink and paper, and everything of that sort is just an empty device. All those words and phrases are based on something people once heard. They are nothing but emptiness. You, Venerable Sir, cling to the mere letter of the doctrine, so of course you tumble about in the void. Question. And do you Chan masters not tumble in the void? We do not. How not? All those writings are the products of wisdom, and where wisdom's mighty function operates, how can there be tumbling about in the void? Where wisdom's mighty function operates, how can there be tumbling about in the void? So, once we bring in the matter of functioning in the world, that's the world of form, it has to be. Functioning means this world of phenomena and form. Then we're not, there's no such division. We're not caught in any so-called void or emptiness. He's saying that to the degree that we're caught in words and concepts, then that is, it's not really functioning. It's not fully embodying the truth. Whereas the functioning is, or potentially is. The so-called void or emptiness is an abstraction if we isolate it from the world of form and phenomena and functioning. It's not real. There is no such thing as emptiness apart from form. It's a concept. It's an abstraction. And that's an abstraction that scholars and those in other schools are vulnerable to believing in this abstraction called emptiness or words and concepts. Here's where he's approached by a Taoist. The Taoists were a huge contingent in 8th century China, 8th and 9th century China. When the popularity of Buddhism grew, they felt threatened and according to what I've read, it was the Taoists who persuaded the emperor of China to go on a persecution of Buddhists. But here is a Taoist, it says, happening to pass by, asked, "Is there anything in the world more marvelous than the forces of nature?" Wei Hai, there is. You know, the Taoists are very, very, very much worshippers of nature, the natural world. Question, and what is that? Wei Hai, the power of comprehending those natural forces. This is really a very potent way of understanding the distinction between Buddhism and Taoism. Is there anything in the world more marvelous than nature? Yes. The power of comprehending those forces, those natural forces. Question, is cosmic vitality the way? Cosmic vitality is a central principle in Taoism. Master, cosmic vitality is cosmic vitality. The Tao is the Tao. The way is the way. Question, if so, they must be two different things. Master, that which knows does not proceed from two different persons. question, what is wrong and what is right? The Master, wrong is the mind that attends to externals. Right is the mind that brings externals under control. Externals meaning the notion of things as external. I would read between the lines here and suggest that he saw in this Taoist as someone who was attached to the world out there. We have the same error in our own English language where we talk about man and nature, two different things, man and nature. That's what it is historically, those two, that idea of that dichotomy. One more here. A Vinaya master named, it doesn't matter. A Vinaya master once came and asked, do you make efforts in your practice of the way, master? Yes, I do. How? When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. And does everybody make the same efforts as you do, master? Not in the same way. Why not? When they are eating, they think of 100 kinds of necessities, and when they are going to sleep, they ponder over affairs of 1,000 different kinds. That is how they differ from me. At this, the Vinaya master was silenced. Here, too, it reads as though he's talking in general terms, they, when they're doing this, but he may very well be pointing to this master, this Vinaya master, as to what he does instead of just eating or just sleeping. That statement of Weihai, when hungry I eat, when tired I sleep. What kind of effort is that? The question is, how do you make efforts? When hungry, I eat. When tired, I sleep. Well, we all know what kind of effort it takes to when eating to just eat. Or if you're working on a koan, to just have mu eat. And when sleeping, to just sleep. Time is up now. We'll stop and recite the four vows. All beings without number, I bow to the great endless blind passions. I bow to above brute dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates beyond measure. I bow to penetrate the great way of Buddha. I bow to attain all beings without number. I bow to liberate endless blind passions. I bow to uproot dharma gates.
beyond measure, I vow to manage it. The great way of Buddha, I vow to attain.